Okay, I do feel a bit daunted. I am used to talking to senior police officers, and actually I feel a lot more frightened talking to you than I do to them. Not only because I'm talking to you, but I've got Amitabha looking at me there, behind you. And he is my he's my sadhana practice. I visualise Amitabha, that's why I've got the red tie on. So I feel like I'm talking to him as well as talking to you. Okay, well, I guess I can only imagine that I've been asked to give this talk. Well, Artur Prey knows me well, and Artur Ketu knows me well. I've known Artur Ketu for probably about 15 years. We lived together in a community for about a Buddhist community for about 6 years. We got ordained together 4 months in Spain. Since then, we've been in the same chapter together. Every Sunday we meet. I have been supporting Artur Ketu with his Mitra study group. So he knows me really well, and he has seen me in my life and the sort of lifestyle that I have led. And I have had a very busy working life, too busy sometimes, to be completely honest. Okay. I have written this talk down only because there's so much of it, and I wanted to sort of whittle it down because I think I'm in danger of going off on tangents, so bear with me if I do read some of this. As Artur Prey said, I do work for myself currently. I was made redundant from what's called the National Policing Improvement Agency last year, last September. It was at the top, you may remember, or may not have been of interest to you, it was at the top of the government's Quango hit list. Anyway, so I knew my time was up. I've been prepared for this for about 18 months. I knew it was coming, and that's absolutely fine. In fact, not only is it fine, I was actually relieved in some ways, to be completely honest with you, because although I find my work meaningful, and it is meaningful work and very worthwhile, I feel like I've been operating on or drawing too much on my overdraft facility. And I have a visceral sense that it is now the time for me to change my life and do something different with it. Excuse me. It's time, I feel, for me to invest more in my more overt, explicit spiritual life, and perhaps invest, put a few more credits in the bank and stop drawing stuff out of it. Okay, so I'm wearing a suit today, as being pointed out. This is what I wear for work. In fact, this is what I was wearing on Thursday. I was working on Thursday, and this is exactly what I wore, so the shirt's a bit dirty. And I came here Friday morning from my workplace. I was working at the National Police College in Hampshire. So this is what I was wearing, this is what I wear, this is what I wear for work. And there is another reason for wearing this today, because I'm going to stop wearing a suit soon. And I feel like this is a bit of a spiritual death, so I'm sort of... This is my funeral, okay, and you're all at it. I'm very happy to be speaking to you. Okay. There's something else I actually I'd like to say as well about wearing the suit, and that is, I don't know whether. Can I just have a raise of hands, please? Who does wear a suit for work? Okay, so there's a few of you. Okay, there's a fair few of you. Okay. When I'm in my workplace. Okay, I'm very conscious of being a Buddhist, and I feel I'm a little bit on the periphery because I'm a Buddhist. Particularly, I've worked in prisons and the police service, so I do feel like a little bit on the periphery, a bit strange and a bit weird. And I wear this suit, and I feel a bit like Mr. Ben. Do you remember Mr. Ben? So he went down the costume shop and he put a costume on, and he played whatever it was that costume is. That's how this suit feels to me. I feel like Mr. Ben when I go to work. However. I also sometimes feel like when I'm in a Buddhist environment, because I work in a, very much out in the world, that I'm not quite doing the Buddhist thing, okay? So I feel on the periphery sometimes of both worlds, and I will come back to that in a moment. So I've got 40 minutes, okay? Time is money, so better get on. Okay. Let's see, how am I doing with time? Okay. Right, okay. Working in the world is a sort of game. It really is a game. But it is a game with serious consequences. Nevertheless, it is a game, and I'd just like to remember that it is a game. Ataketu described dharmas as dreams, and in a way, you know, the world is a bit like a dream, but it's also a bit of a game. To get on and have any chance of being successful in this game, you have to be aware of both the explicit and the implicit rules of that game. Now, there's lots of games going on in the world. Depending on which part of the world you work in, these rules are more or less complicated. If you think on a continuum from team-based right livelihood at this end, and politics, the world of politics, which people, some people work in, and I sort of have a tangential into that world, then team-based right livelihood is perhaps at the end of the spectrum where the rules are more explicit and more open and transparent. And then politics, the rules are much more ambiguous and complicated. For most of my working life, I think I've probably worked maybe a bit of a third or half the way in from team-based right livelihood. Most of my work, I think, hasn't been in the thick of it, although I have had a couple of years perhaps down that end of the spectrum. And how I'd describe that end of the spectrum is tricky. If you're going to be a Buddhist, it's very tricky working down that end of the spectrum. Okay, so I'm going to paint a few scenarios for you. Now, this is it. I use this model with my clients. Okay, it's one I've come up with because they, and often my senior police clients, have a similar dilemma, I think, to us as Buddhists, or a lot of them do. And I have to say, I've been really impressed. I know I'm from Liverpool. I grew up in a normal sort of area, went to a comp and all that sort of thing. My view of the police was never that great when I was growing up. It was at the time of the, miners' strikes and all that sort of thing, and I was, definitely on Arthur Scargill's side at the time. But my experience of them has been generally is actually they are very ethical and they are working in a very difficult environment, and actually most of the time they are trying their best, especially senior officers. So this is a model I use with them, but I think it applies to us too, as Buddhists trying to operate in the world. Okay, so two typical consultancy 2x2 matrix. Okay, for those who are familiar with consultancy. Okay, so what we have on this axis here, okay, is self-awareness, and what we have down here is game awareness. Okay. Okay. I'll talk you through it. Okay, scenario one. Scenario one is you're not aware of the game, so you don't know the rules of the game, and you're not aware of yourself. Okay? So you don't know what you stand for, you don't know what your values are, you don't know what your values are, your Buddhist values. And you don't know where your ethics are. Okay? So that's here. Okay? And if you're in that quadrant here, effectively, you're a pawn. Okay? You're going to get used and abused by everyone else in the game. If you're in the game. If you're in the game, you're going to get used and abused by everybody else. Not only are you a pawn, you might be a prawn and beaten by the sharks. Okay? So watch out. Okay? So it's a very naive quadrant to be in, and really you don't want to be in the world if that's where you are. Scenario two, you're self-aware, so you've got a clear understanding and you're certain about your values and your ethics as a Buddhist, but you're not game aware. So where are we? High self-aware, low game aware. And how I would describe this is probably, okay, a dropout, a bit of a beach bump or a dropout. Possibly. So what happens is, if you're in that quadrant, you're highly self-aware but you're not game-aware, you will either drop out of the game because you can't stand it, or the games that everyone else is playing, or you will get kicked out because you don't know the rules. Scenario three. You're game-aware, but you're not self-aware. That's here. And I describe this as being a cog. So you know what you know what the game is. You know how to play the game. You may be expert at playing the game, but you don't know you don't know your own values, or you don't have them very deeply. Now the problem with being in quadrant three is that is actually, as I say here, you become a cog. You join the machine. You become the game. You actually become, if anyone's seen The Matrix, you become part of The Matrix. So you may well be successful at the game, but you lose your integrity and your sense of self, your higher self, in that process. Scenario four. So this is the final and the only long-term viable option for a practicing Buddhist to be working in the world. You've got to be game-aware and you have to be self-aware. You need to put energy into both of those things. This is the only option that enables you to play the game with any chance of success without compromising yourself. However, and there's a caution here, developing and maintaining game awareness requires continual effort. If you want to win the game, you want to be in the game, you have to put effort into playing that game and knowing the rules, and the rules will change subtly all the time. You also need to develop and maintain your self-awareness, and that also requires continuous effort. If you're in a game at the tricky end of the continuum, so the political end of the continuum, it can be absolutely exhausting. Now, I've not been at that end of the game, but I have seen others who are, and they are generally exhausted, and sometimes they become very bland people because they can't reveal themselves. There is one more scenario, and I think this is the scenario I've often been in, and this is... So these people up here, what do I call them? Scenario four. I can't remember what I call them. Okay, but in our case, I know what they are. Okay. If you're in this quadrant, if you're a Buddhist and you're doing this really well, I think you're a spiritual warrior. You're in the world and you're doing your Buddhist stuff as well. You're living ethically with integrity. As I say, there is one more place to be, and I think this is sometimes where I've been, and it's here. That's somewhere in the middle. So, you know, I have some understanding of self, of my ethics and where I stand on my values, and I've had some understanding of the game. So, moderately self-aware, moderately game-aware. And I think this is an okay holding position for a time. But it's not a long-term proposition if you want to either be successful in the game or go anywhere with your spiritual life. It was interesting actually listening to, and I'm glad you said it, Artur Priya, about me being a monk in the valley. There has, if I'm completely frank, always been a part of me that's been resistant to engaging in the world, and it goes back a long way. And I know this isn't how it looks. I'm sure this isn't how it looks from the outside, but it is true. Despite having spent so much time in the world and, you know, doing the work stuff, I have had and still have an enduring archetype which has been and is gnawing away at me, and it is that of the monk. Recently, I was unpacking some boxes, and I discovered a photo of a painting I made when I was about 17. I was at school at the time. It's quite a surreal painting. And I'm not going to go into describing it now. But in the painting there was a ruined monastery. And in the shadows of this monastery, there was a monk. I painted a monk in a habit. And a little strangely, because I wouldn't have understood this at the time, there was a column, stone column next to the monk. And wrapped around the monk, was three times, was a serpent with like a dragon's head. So from my perspective now as a Buddhist, you know, I can read into that and say it's a Naga. I don't know what it was at the time, but I like to think that it's a Naga. So it was telling me something about my future. 2 years after I painted that picture, a couple of years later, I went to live on a kibbutz. And the people there knew that I could paint a little bit. I'm not a great artist by any stretch of the imagination. That's why I left art college, because I knew I'd never make it. But anyway, they knew I could paint. Anyway, we used a bomb bunker, basically, as a bar cum nightclub. Anyway, not, not a, Anyway. I was young. Okay. Anyway, they asked me to paint something on the wall. They wanted a mural. And I don't know why I painted this, but I was inspired to paint a row of monks, again, in habits. And also, next to this painting, on another wall, and again, I find this quite strange, but I'm probably reading too much into it, I painted an empty rowing boat on a riverbank. So, since then, I've had lots of monk dreams. In one, I was in a Tibetan monastery, I was in a shrine room, a Tibetan shrine room, so it wasn't quite like this. And Chinese soldiers were trying to get in. Anyway, they did get in, and then one was pointing a rifle at me, and I knew I was going to be shot. I actually wasn't that bothered, because I knew I had lived the life I wanted to live. So it's something you might want to try yourself, just to sort of get in touch with your own myths, and, you know, where your energy is. And this is an exercise I sometimes do with my clients. I ask them to write a list of the books they've most enjoyed, the music they've most enjoyed, the films they've most enjoyed, and TV programs. All those sort of things. Just lists, lists. Don't tell them why I'm doing it. So you've got one up on them. And then once you've generated your lists, you then analyse them with a view to identifying themes and trends. Now, when I did this on myself, because I wanted to try this exercise out myself, I wasn't doing it conscious, you know, I was just genuinely writing down what I was interested in. One of the themes was again, monks. So one of my favourite paintings, some of you may know it, is of St. Francis by Francisco de Zurbarán in the National Galleries. He's in a habit, and he's looking up to God, I think, with his hands clasped with a skull in his arms. My favourite book is The Glass Bead Game. I don't know if anybody's read that. It's a fantastic book. And the main character is a sort of secular monk. I thoroughly recommend that book. Some of my favourite films, Name of the Rose. Sean Connery plays William of Baskerville, Franciscan friar. Fantastic. Another favourite film, Crouching Tiger. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Li Mu Bai, you know, the main character again. I think he's a Taoist monk. And then, of course, favourite TV series, or one of them, Kung Fu. Okay. All right, so the myth of the monk, it's alive and well, okay, but it's been bubbling away in the background. So as you can see, but having said all that, I do appreciate I have a bit of a dilemma, because that is so strong in me, and I'm standing here talking to you about how to use your energy in the world. So basically, how the talk's going to pan out from here is I've given you a model here, okay, and I'm going to finish with another model, which is basically saying the same sort of thing in a different way about how to use your energy in a world. And I don't think there are any easy answers. It's not a comfortable. I'm not going to tell you anything which is going to be particularly comforting. So what's meant by in the world? I've probably already started on this, haven't I? Well, we're all in the world, as we all know. But I do think this weekend, entitling a weekend Energy in the World does suggest something specific about the world or a type of world. In the life of Siddhartha, in his early life, we are told that a prediction is made that he's either going to be a great worldly leader, monarch, or he's going to be a spiritual leader and teacher. So very early on in the Buddha's life story, there's a distinction being made between what's spiritual and what's worldly. Later on in his life, the world, if you like, is symbolised by the two extremes on the pleasure-pain continuum. On the one side, there's the luxurious palace of delights and sensual pleasures where Siddhartha grows up. On the other, there's the city where he witnesses the less palatable facts of life. The first three sites, old age, sickness and death. So the world is both a place of pleasure and of pain. The spiritual, by comparison, is symbolised by the fourth site, the wandering mendicant, as well as the swapping of Siddhartha's princely clothes for rags and venturing into the forest, effectively going forth into the homeless life. Once again, a sort of dichotomy is set up between the worldly and the spiritual. And I think often when I have when I read Buddhist texts, I have sometimes felt that distinction quite sharply. You know, am I leading a worldly life or am I leading a spiritual life? Perhaps the clearest and most explicit model of the world from a Buddhist perspective is depicted by the Tibetan Wheel of Life and its six realms. So the God realm, the Titan realm, the Hungry Ghost realm, the Hell realm, the Animal realm, the Human realm. Some people say that, you know, some people do, in some parts of the world, do literally believe that these realms exist. Others say that they're nothing more than projections of our mind. It's the, you know, it's the world experienced through the filter of our mental states. But these, I don't think these two perspectives, extreme perspectives, aren't mutually exclusive, that they actually do fit together quite well. I know from my own experience, Osprey said I've worked as an organisational psychologist, and I have been in organisations, and I know from my own experience of going into organisations that if enough people share a similar mental state or type of mental state, then the attitudes and active behaviours that flow from that create what feels like an objective reality, an environment or a world with a very distinctive and discernible flavour, a sort of an atmosphere or an ethos. And we're creating a world here because of that, because of our shared mental states. So for the purpose of the talk, I think we can consider team-based right livelihood that we heard about yesterday as being something akin to, at its best, being in the human realm. And anything outside of that is probably got the flavour of the other five realms. What I'd like to do is give you an example of working, of my own experience, of working in a realm, a particular realm. Several years ago, let me backtrack a little bit. I spent most of my working life in the public sector. And several years ago, I found myself questioning my motives for staying there because I really wasn't finding it very fulfilling. Now, after much deliberation, I concluded that the reason I stayed there and stayed there so long is because I was actually afraid of leaving. The private sector seemed like a shark-infested water, and I really wasn't sure that I'd be able to survive the cut and thrust of it. So, if you like, I was afraid of being a prawn. A few years prior to this, I'd trained as a counsellor, and whilst on the course, I committed to myself that I would acknowledge, confront, and address my demons and fears. And that was for two reasons. First of all, being that I didn't want to be controlled by them for the rest of my life. And secondly, because I didn't want to feel like a hypocrite when I was encouraging other people to do the same thing. So with this in mind and my integrity at stake, I left my relatively safe but boring job in the public sector and joined a very, very commercial consultancy firm. On quite a deep level, this really did go against the grain of my being, but on another level, I knew it was the right thing to do, at least for a time. Now, I know this talk's being recorded, and I hope it doesn't go public too far. Okay. The guy who directed the firm, who I worked for directly, I experienced as an archetypal titan. So I'd like to just describe, this is my experience of him, so it's probably not very objective. He was about 6'3" or 6'4", often wore a pinstripe suit. I found him to be extremely competitive, extremely assertive, and had this sort of natural sense of entitlement about him. He seemed to be suspicious of everyone, including me. He was very, very political and manipulative. He was very moody and often very volatile. He was excellent stage 4 Meta Bhavna material. and he has been in my Meta Bhavna often. His Titan personality pervaded the atmosphere of the organisation. It really was a Titan realm where I never felt I could relax. And in many respects, I hated being there. However, and I do want to emphasise this, I am extremely grateful for the opportunity of having worked with that man and in that organisation, because it's helped me to grow in all sorts of ways. I had to push myself beyond what I'd previously thought was possible, and in doing so, my sense of confidence, my ability to work in the world, mushroomed. So it was a really, in some respects, a really beneficial experience for me. So that's one way I use my energy. So I hope we have a shared understanding of what I mean by the world. I'm talking mainly about the world at that end of the spectrum, the more extreme end, where it can so often be ruthless and competitive. I'm talking about the atomized, materialistic world where the power mode rather than the love mode rules, where our worth as a human being is judged by the clothes we wear. That's why I wear a suit. The car we drive, the size of our house, our appearance, our accent, our education, our political and economic clout. I'm talking here about the world dominated by the viparyasas, the topsy-turvy views, where what's really ugly is seen as beautiful, where what's unskillful is regarded as skillful, and so on. This is the world of conflicting agendas vying for our attention, our time, our money, and of course, our energy. Ultimately, it's a hypocritical world, which on the one hand promises happiness, while simultaneously encouraging conformity, addiction, and ignorance. It's where we're blown this way and that, and sometimes blown off our feet by the eight worldly winds. It's the voraciously hungry, short-sighted, and deluded world that in its eagerness to make something of itself is also literally consuming itself to death. This is the conventional secular world at that end of the spectrum that doesn't concern itself with our spiritual values and aspirations. I imagine we're all, to some extent, familiar with it, because it's difficult, if not impossible, to avoid it. So that's my definition of the world. You can see I've had a bad rap. Okay. Energy. So what's energy? Saraj told us yesterday about energy. I will say a little bit more, and I'll reiterate one or two things. So energy, basically, in a Buddhist sense, is virya, energy in pursuit of the good, the third aspect of the enlightened mind, alongside wisdom and compassion. Sangharakshita, in Know Your Mind, describes it as an intentedness on or a powerful inclination towards the skillful. And it should be obvious from what I've said already that if you're going to operate in the world, you need it in abundance. Okay, so we heard, virya, if you like, is personified by Vajrapani. Sometimes, I think this has been alluded to already, sometimes Vajrapani is described in his wrathful form. And he is quite a character. I think Artapriya described him when he first encountered him as being a little bit looking like a devil. He is. He looks like he's a bull of a bodhisattva. He's not the sort of chap you're going to mess with. And he's the sort of bold, focused, fearless, determined energy, sort of nothing's going to get in his way. So that's Vajrapani. Did I say Vajrasattva before? I meant Vajrapani. And Vajrapani can also, as we know, be in peaceful form. So this energy can manifest in a gentler, but nevertheless still tenacious sort of way. And I think, it's about, if you're going to be in the world, you need to be able to use that spectrum of energy. The gentle form of energy and the bolder, in-your-face sort of energy as well. It's all required. It's not always necessary to use a sledgehammer or even a vajra to crack a nut. The Abhidharma, which is, the Buddhist psychology, describes virya as having five different characteristics. Now I'm going to put my hands up here and say I didn't get this from the original source. So it's a secondary source, so I hope it's right. So the first type of virya, or characteristic of virya, is ever-ready energy. Nothing to do with batteries. This is the energy of preparedness. So it's a preparedness that includes all of us, our body, our heart, and our mind. It's the sort of integrated energy that's stored up and ready to be released as soon as the opportunity arises. So that's ever-ready energy. Then we have the energy of applied work. The people I work with describe this as the JFDI principle. And I don't know if you know what the JFDI principle is. Just do it. Okay, so this is the energy of applied work. It's just getting on with whatever needs doing, regardless of how you feel about it. And I really appreciate being around people who exemplify this type of energy. For example, they see the bins full, so they just empty it. They don't ask who filled it, why they filled it. They don't hum and haw about it. They do it and they don't tell you about it. They just get on with it, they just do it. Okay? So that's the energy of applied work, and it's something I really respect and enjoy being around. Then there's energy that doesn't lose heart. This is the energy of staying positive and on track in the face of challenges and difficulties. Then there's the energy that doesn't turn back. This is the energy of sticking with something, even when it becomes difficult to do so. It's the tenacious energy of a finisher-completer. For several years, Buddhashanti, my friend, has almost single-handedly been running the Liverpool Buddhist Centre. He lives in Manchester, it's about 35 miles away. He goes over to Liverpool a couple of times a week, or has been going over to Liverpool a couple of times a week on public transport. And I know he usually doesn't get home till very late in the evening. And I also know this is very tiring. And I'm sure there have been times when actually he would prefer not to have got on that train. But he has. That is the energy of, well, the energy that doesn't look back. That tenacious, just getting on with it energy, regardless of how you feel. And finally, there's the energy that's never satisfied. This is the energy that doesn't become complacent or self-satisfied. It knows and accepts that there's always more to be done, and therefore it just carries on. Now, using contemporary language, we might appropriately describe these five characteristics of virya in one word, and that one word is conscientiousness. Although they are more than conscientiousness. It's interesting to note that modern research has consistently identified this as the strongest personality trait that determines success in almost every field of human endeavour. Sadaraji yesterday was talking about artists and how they just, you know, stick at it. They exemplify this quality, or that all successful artists do, even some not successful artists. Okay, so it goes across all areas of human endeavour. Those who demonstrate conscientiousness to a high degree are those who are generally successful. Those who stick at something until it's completed and never become complacent. Of course, people who have this characteristic are going to be successful. Why wouldn't they? It's this conscientiousness that we need to be successful Buddhists in the world. It's perhaps not surprising that the Buddha's last words were the exhortation, "I declare to you, all conditioned things are of a nature to decay. Strive on unceasingly." Okay. What I'm going to do in this little bit of the talk, I think I've got about 10 minutes, is that right? Left here, is talk about being human. This isn't a talk really about how to live out the Bodhisattva ideal in the world, as important as I think that is. I'm trying to bring it right down to earth, literally down to earth. I'm exploring something which is far more basic, and I personally feel this is sometimes overlooked and neglected. I'm focusing on putting our energy into mundane, everyday existence. And this includes our work. Someone in my chapter recently told me that, in fact it was last week, told me that Dana Vera, one of the order members, describes himself as a human being first and a Buddhist second. And I think this is wonderful. It makes so much sense. Some of us are too keen to be too spiritual, too fast, without first of all just engaging in the world and learning the essential lessons that I believe the world has to teach us. I know I've been guilty of this in the past, and maybe I sometimes still am. Of the Buddha's teachings, my mind usually turns to those teachings to the monks and nuns who'd gone forth into the homeless life. You know, the lofty spiritual teachings about the direct path to the ultimate goal, with a capital G. But he also gave teachings to people living in what we might call secular lives in the world. The Pali Canon is peppered with suttas where the Buddha engages householders, family men, merchants, murderers and kings. as well as teaching the supreme goal of nirvana, the release from the cycle of rebirths by practicing the Eightfold Path. The Buddha also, and I think significantly, taught what seemed to be quite pragmatic principles about how to optimize our welfare and happiness in this present life, in the mundane world. Such teachings don't necessarily tell us how to go all the way. They don't tell us always how to get enlightened in this life. They just tell us how to be happy, healthy, integrated human beings. And I believe this is the precursor to a mature spiritual life. This is exemplified in the Buddha's advice to a family man called Bhyakapaja. So Bhyakapaja says a family man, he goes to the Buddha and he says, you know, often in the case of sutras, tell me how to live my life. And the Buddha says, there are, Bhyakapaja, four things that lead to the welfare and happiness of a family man in this very life. What four? The accomplishment of persistent effort, the accomplishment of protection, good friendship, and balanced living. And what is the accomplishment of persistent effort? Here, Bhyakapaja, whatever may be the means by which a family man earns his living, whether by farming, trade, cattle raising, archery, or civil service, or by some other craft, he is skillful and diligent. He investigates the appropriate means and is able to act and arrange everything properly. This is called the accomplishment of persistent effort. And what is the accomplishment of protection? Here, Bhyakapaja, a family sets up protection and guard over the wealth acquired by energetic striving. Amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth righteously gained, thinking, how can I prevent kings and bandits from taking this away? Fire from burning it, floods from sweeping it off, and unloved heirs from taking it. This is called the accomplishment of protection. And what is good friendship? Here, Bhyakapaja, in whatever village or town a family man dwells, he associates with householders or their sons, whether young or old, who are of mature virtue, accomplished in faith, moral discipline, generosity, and wisdom. He converses with them and engages in discussions with them. He emulates them in regard to their accomplishment in faith, moral discipline, generosity, and wisdom. This is called good friendship. And what is balanced living? Here, Bhyakapaja, a family man knows his income and expenditure and leads a balanced life, neither extravagant nor miserly, so that his income exceeds his expenditure rather than the reverse. Just as a goldsmith or his apprentice holding up a scale knows, by so much it has dipped down, by so much it has tilted up, so a family man leads a balanced life. So later on in the same sutta, the Buddha does go on to describe what one should do to be happy in the next life, but I'm not going to talk about that now. So let's stay with the basics and what the Buddha recommends. What he says to Bhyakapaja is basically four things. Be skillful and diligent at your work so that you can earn enough to support yourself and your family. Then look after what you've earned. Cultivate and maintain friendships with those who are generous, ethical, and wise. And finally, don't be stingy and don't be extravagant by spending more than you earn. So if we were to boil this down into just 2 points, then the Buddha is saying, in my interpretation, be hardworking and competent at what you do in the world. And secondly, cultivate relationships that support your ideals. Now looking at, I couldn't help but find correlations in modern psychology with what the Buddha is saying here. It's how I'm conditioned as a psychologist to think psychologically, so bear with me. When Freud was asked what a normal person should be able to do well, he said, Leben und Arbeiten, love and work. Carl Jung, a student of Freud's, another psychologist who thought ended up thinking quite differently from him in many respects, did think similarly in this respect though, and he elaborated on it. And I think what he has to say is useful to us as spiritual practitioners. What Jung says is the primary task of the first half of one's life is to develop a healthy sense of who you are, if you like, to integrate and to develop a healthy ego. In Sangharakshita's terms, it might be to become an individual. And this is achieved in two areas. This, we do it through working in two parts of our lives. The first is developing competence in building and maintaining loving relationships. And the second is through developing competence in the world of work. Once we've achieved this, if we do ever achieve it, then we're in a pretty good or strong position to start cultivating wisdom, at least from Jung's perspective. So it seems that competence in the world, primarily through our work and our relationships, is a foundation for integrated or mature spiritual development. I'm not going to talk about this now, but those of you who know Maslow's hierarchy, and it's a pretty common model, he's saying exactly the same thing. So I'm not suggesting here that we need to be fully sorted out before we engage in the spiritual life. I certainly wasn't, and I'm still not. However, I am suggesting that it might be useful to consider using our worldly life of work and relationships. to find work and relationships that we enjoy, and then put a lot of energy into developing our sense of competence and confidence in those two areas as a basis for moving forward in our spiritual life. I'm going to finish with another model and a poem. Hopefully the poem will be a little bit more uplifting than some of the rest of the talk. It is tempting when giving a Dharma talk to want to be idealistic. So what I'd like to do is present a model that connects that idealism with our worldly life. Okay. So you may recall at the very beginning I talked about the distinction between the worldly and the spiritual, and that is set up quite clearly in the life of the Buddha. Now we might want to represent the spiritual idealistic side of ourselves as being a helium balloon. So imagine here a helium balloon. Here it is. Okay, I'm just going to put it there. There it is. Its natural tendency is to ascend upwards into the sky. It's uplifting, inspired, optimistic, full of dreams, visions, and possibilities. It wants to transcend and be free of the mundane world, and requires that everything, and I mean everything, is given over to that which is higher. I know I have this spiritually idealistic tendency within me. It's been with me for most of my life. I sense that it's something so much. There is something so much more to strive for. This is the part of me that identifies with the myth of the monk, and I've already told you about that. It's also worth noting this: it's this same ascendant tendency that's caused me so much angst in my life, or at least in my earlier life. Once I'd finished university, I went travelling around South America and returned home to start my working life. My family are lovely, caring, generous people, but at that time I experienced their values as too worldly and materialistic. In fact, it's how I experienced much of the world around me. Reflecting on it now, I see that what I wanted to pursue was something pure that was untainted by the world. I wanted to live my ideals, and of course that wasn't going to be possible because my ideals were naive and I was unintegrated. The world I wanted to live in was a fantasy world that simply didn't exist. My head was in the clouds and I was in danger of drifting off into orbit. So there we have the helium balloon. Now I want you to imagine one of those old-fashioned lead weights, the size of a football. Do you remember those round ones with a handle? This is very solidly and firmly planted on the ground, and the force of gravity is pushing it down into the earth. This is conditioned existence, or mundane reality, or what I've just been calling the world. As I described earlier, depending on our mental state, this can be experienced as any one of the realms of the Tibetan Wheel of Life. I've told you about my experience of working in a commercial consultancy, which was a sort of Titan realm. For a few years, this was the world that I lived in. I worked long hours. I was often travelling by taxi, train and plane. And at least two or three nights a week, I was staying away in hotels and conference centres. I'm naturally quite introverted by nature, and I don't enjoy drinking, or at least not a lot. But it was expected of me to socialise at dinner and then afterwards in the bar with clients. It was an intrinsic part of the job. Small talk would often drift towards topics I have no interest in. Cricket, cars, the financial market, reality TV. My life was full and busy. Every other weekend I was looking after and entertaining my son, and then on the weekends off, I was washing and ironing shirts, catching up on sleep and snatching time with friends. And I'm sure that my friendship suffered as a consequence. In addition to all this, I wasn't getting on retreat or attending order weekends as often as I'd liked. I often found it difficult to maintain a regular daily meditation practice. Being busy and rushing about is definitely the enemy of empathy, both for oneself and for others. Working for my Titan boss, and I do feel compelled to say that he did have some positive qualities too, but working for my Titan boss and leading a hectic lifestyle that I didn't enjoy meant I experienced a persistent undercurrent of anxiety. However, I was hard working, and after 6 months I received a pay rise, and after 12 months I was promoted to senior consultant and received another fairly substantial pay rise. This enabled me to put down a deposit on a house, and I bought a new car. I was aware of the risks of my lifestyle, and I can see looking back now how I did sometimes get too enmeshed and caught up in it. It's an insidious process of becoming less than human. There were times when I was an automaton, mindlessly doing what I needed to do in order to get through the day. I'd forgotten sometimes why I'd taken the job in the first place, and I'd find myself buying things to take the edge off or compensate for my lack of satisfactoriness. I'm describing my experience here, but I don't think what I'm describing is unique to me. In fact, I think it's quite common. The specific details may be different, but what I experience is probably regarded as normal and okay by a significant proportion of the population. So now I'd like you to imagine that we have the helium balloon up there and the weight of mundane existence down here. Now I'm tethering the balloon to the weight. The balloon is pushing up, trying to rise, and the weight is pulling down. The string between them is taut with tension between those two opposing forces. I used to experience that tension as stressful, and sometimes I still do. I'm living my messy, mundane life in samsara right now, and I'm constantly reminded of something so much better up there. I want to escape from this world in order to live in that world. Occasionally, I would go on retreat and I'd feel like I'd escaped, albeit temporarily, a bit like this weekend. However, over the past few years, I've come to realise that this is such a wrong and unhelpful, though probably completely understandable, experience and view. The spiritual idealism of the balloon is, in fact, no more spiritual than the material idealism of the weight, because it represents a disembodied fantasy world that exists only in my wishful thinking. Our working ground, my working ground, is represented by this connecting piece of string, which so often in the past, as I say, I've just experienced as unsatisfactoriness. This is the tension that exists between my current earthly reality and my as yet unrealised spiritual potential. If this tension is too much, and I think sometimes it is for some people, they might simply cut the balloon free in order to be rid of the tension. They just let go of their ideals. Or they might simply allow the helium balloon to slowly deflate, imperceptibly, perhaps, over time, which means they wake up one day in the thick of material idealism, wondering where their spiritual life went. Alternatively, we can do what's difficult. We can embrace and creatively work with this tension. We can translate our lofty ideals into embodied ethical actions and speech. I'm not necessarily talking about anything mammoth here. Little and often is, I'm sure, far more helpful to our development than occasional grand gestures. I know I painted quite a bleak picture of my time of working in the commercial world, commercial consultancy, But as I said earlier, I've never regretted it, and I don't regret it. Despite sometimes sinking into material idealism, I did on the whole stay in touch with my spiritual ideals. In fact, being in the Titan world often reminded me just how much I wanted to be human. And this was, in some ways, very helpful. I probably worked harder than I have ever worked at practicing the ethical precepts. I was scrupulously honest about my expenses. I didn't steal time from the firm when I had opportunities to do so. I was transparent and straightforward with clients. I persuaded the firm to donate to the Woodland Trust to offset our heavy carbon footprint. When I was socialising with clients, I'd make a pint of beer or a glass of wine stretch out for the whole evening. And I'd always eat the poor vegetarian option that was on the menu. When I travelled, I took my Dharma books with me and I read them in stations and airports. I got into the habit of visualising Amitabha, my sadhana practice, and silently chanting his mantra every time I took off and landed in a plane. I carried a folding meditation stool in my luggage, and when I had the opportunity, I'd snatch 20 or 30 minutes to meditate. These are small things, but they mattered. And I'm certain, excuse me, that because they were practiced in what felt like adverse conditions, they not only made my faith and resolve stronger, they also helped me become more competent and human in the world. So, I think there is, I hope, a happy-ish ending to this. It's not finished yet, though, is it? Okay. So after nearly 2 years of working in the commercial consultancy, I decided I'd achieved what I set out to do, and I applied for a job somewhere else. I went for the interview, and it went well. I felt I had a reasonable chance of getting it, but it wasn't in the bag. There were other candidates being interviewed, and I wouldn't know the outcome for a few weeks. In the interim period, my colleague, another consultant who I was quite friendly with, came into the office and told me that she was moving to another part of the country. And she also told me, she was leaving the firm and she'd arranged a meeting that morning to tell our boss, the Titan, and another company director. I sensed that once they'd been told this, they would immediately go into planning mode, which would involve shifting my colleague's work in my direction until a new consultant was employed to replace her. However, I knew if this happened and I was accepted for the job that I'd applied for, then the firm would be left in a potentially vulnerable position, quite a sticky position, financial position, really. This was an ethical dilemma for me because I didn't trust my boss to treat me fairly if I was open and honest with him. Nevertheless, I did what I viscerally felt was the right thing to do. Immediately after my colleague had ended her meeting with the directors, I went in and explained my position. As I had feared, I was treated with disdain, told to pack my desk and given a month's notice. I have to say, I'm not so usually so brave or bold, but in this instance, something within me had urged me to go beyond myself. This something was the awareness of the tension between my current experience of myself and my potential for being something more, something better, something closer to my Buddhist ideal, which is Amitabha. Anyway, I'm pleased to say that I did get the job I applied for. And this actually turned out to be the best job I've ever done, the job in which I have been happiest. However, I would never have had the confidence or the skills to do that job had I not tested my limits, or been worked to my limits with the Titan. Work is sometimes described as the tantric guru, and in retrospect, my Titan boss was a bit of a marper, and I appreciate what he did for me. I am going to finish with a poem. If you don't mind me, it's okay. Okay, this is a poem that was given to me on my 18th birthday. It was in my birthday card. It was actually printed on my birthday card from my parents. And when I was unpacking the box and I found that photo of the monk, the picture of the monk, I found this birthday card. It was my 18th birthday card, and I was quite touched finding it. And I know it's going to be very familiar to you, and it is a little bit of a cliched poem, a bit cheesy, but I'd like you to listen to it, bearing in mind the five characteristics of virya. And I'll just remind you what the five characteristics of virya are. They are energy that is ever ready, the energy of applied work, the energy that doesn't lose heart, the energy that doesn't turn back, and the energy that's never satisfied. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise, if you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to, broken, and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss, and lose and start again at your beginnings, and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they have gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man, my son. Thank you.